Hello. This podcast is part of Unpacking Knowledges, the Argekunst public program for 2022, curated by BAU. Unpacking Knowledges will activate the knowledge hidden in the local landscape and relate it to the artistic practices in the current exhibition program at Argekunst. Histories, places, images, artifacts, artificially created and naturally formed objects all contain potential knowledge of the past. This knowledge is more than just a collection of carefully selected, catalogued and archived objects. It also carries the histories, ideas and approaches of all those who relate to the objects and attribute significance to them. As part of Reading Rivers, you will now listen to selected texts while walking by a river.
Catherine Russell, Active Archives, Rocks, Relationships and Reasoning. Most days we feed into an archive, such as a social media algorithm, and add to our own, perhaps by downloading a new music album or ebook. Such archives are passive and personal, and we readily recognise them to be growing, because we hold a relationship with them. In this text, I hope to show that an active archive is not only one that grows, but one with which a relationship is maintained. By engaging with archives, observing them with curiosity, and postulating new ideas within and beyond them, we can learn a tremendous amount and think toward new hypotheses and even develop solutions. The Geology Archive at the University of Leicester, where I have both studied and taught, is full of amazing things. However, while the collections are regularly added to, the newest editions are not always the most frequently used. The classic specimens, splendid examples of rocks, fossils, and minerals, sit at the surface of the collections, as staff frequently use them to show potential students, current students, and visitors alike how each connects to the story of the natural world. However, these high-use specimens are just the tip of the iceberg. When staff and students undertake research, they may work with specimens from the archive. Depending on the hypothesis and analysis required, the specimen under inspection may meet several people as well as analytical instruments during the research, and in some cases, it will return to the archive in several pieces. For example, a hand specimen, a fragment of rock shaped to be easily held and examined, of hubnerite-bearing ore from Colorado in the US, has been sliced to form a polished slab and a thin section. A slither, only 30 nanometers thick, about as thick as a human hair, to be allowed for detailed inspection of the minerals in the rock. Additionally, a specimen may need to be tested for its chemical properties. Such analysis can be done by non-destructive means, but some equipment requires a small part of the hand specimen to be ground to powder and then compressed into a pellet for analysis, and these pellets themselves may then be archived. It is interesting to note that the information that, through this process, will or will not change. In the case of the hubnerite-bearing ore, the sample will always be from Colorado, and the minerals will always stay the same. However, what is known about the minerals may change, which, in turn, may result in alterations to how researchers understand the landscape changes that this rock endured over millions of years. Additionally, depending on the scientist's access to analytical equipment, some mysteries may have to go uninvestigated. Changing archives in a changing world. Archives of every kind are teeming with potential and await fresh curiosity so that their stories can be told and built upon. Their ability to accumulate material and information makes them fascinating, almost wise, such that searching through their dusty cartons is like uncovering memories. The volume of knowledge, the number of stories, and the cleverly cross-referenced and curated records make it easy to see why so many comparisons exist between the archive and the human mind. However, just like a human mind, archives can fall prey to blind spots and bias, which is simultaneously a challenge and what enables each collection to be unique and a reflection of its history. If we consider rocks to be memories, as many geologists do, then it begins to make sense that the landscapes most often experienced by an archive's collectors have the highest representation in the collection. For example, the Leicester collection has proportionally more rocks from Leicester than from, say, Edinburgh, and vice versa. An archive in its entirety is biased towards the interest of the individual or individuals who contribute material to it. And in the case of archives containing research materials, the stored samples may themselves be biased towards projects that receive funding from internal or external bodies, each of which have their own interests. Particularly in research, it is critical to address any marked bias in an archive, if only to highlight the limitations of a data set, which may unfortunately be unavoidable due to access or financial constructs. As such, the roots and models of organisation within an archive may be revisited periodically to aid our use of their information. As time goes on, archives continue to grow, adapt, and shift to accommodate new questions and requirements. With a changing world at our feet, geology archives around the world have begun to incorporate plastic, pollutants, and other anthropogenic materials, as researchers seek to understand the impact of human activities on the Earth's natural systems and what Earth's future natural archive may contain. As such, some collated samples at Leicester are remarkably recent. For example, I've been researching sediment from the Mississippi River in the US and looking for microplastic. The Mississippi River sediment samples were treated to an initial chemical analysis to check for any harmful concentrations of pollutants before undergoing a laser scan to access the size of each grain of sand in a sample. The sediment then entered many phases of preparation in search of microplastics, including sieving and mixing the sediment with zinc bromide, a corrosive solution that allows for easy separation of microplastics from the sediment. As the story unfolds, the juxtaposition of the anthropogenic Mississippi River sediment sitting within Leicester's geology archive is remarkable and striking to me. The plastic-littered sand is stored alongside core from a petroleum reservoir. I wonder if the hydrocarbons found in the petroleum reservoir from which the core was taken could have been refined into plastic pellets, manufactured, used, and disposed of, and now their fragments sit in the Mississippi sand right next to their sisters. I have similar thoughts about the sand and its sandstone, but in the ancient record, such relationships are, largely, geographically constrained. The Anthropocene, by contrast, presents geologists with the novelty of seamlessly unconstrained transportation across the entire globe. So, it might remain impossible to know for sure where the hydrocarbons in the Mississippi sample originated from, and if they are connected somehow to the adjacent core. Hence, sediment samples like this one capture a new process of material flow into the geological archive, giving rise to new questions and opening up countless possibilities. Today, researchers have access to the most complete picture possible of the causes and effects of change and response in natural systems than from any other time in geological history. So when we compare selections of modern archival materials with those of the ancient past, we find a similarity in researchers' decisions to choose material samples for their novelty or impressive nature. However, until now, this has also always meant choosing from the limited windows of preserved material that the Earth have passively archived. When collecting Anthropocene material, researchers don't need to worry about basins, partial preservation, and interpretation in the same way at all. For the first time, it is possible for us to make the decision on what will be archived, and thus to select the story that the future scientists and societies will tell about the Earth. How will this be done? Who has the power to decide what will be important? How much of what is considered normal will be lost because it isn't deemed interesting today? Each of these questions will be answered differently by everyone, and perhaps an active archive built by everyone, one that accommodates many perspectives, conversations, and approaches, is precisely the archive that we need to make, and indeed, may already be making. The Atlas Group. Let's be honest, the rain helped. The truth of the documents we archive slash collect does not depend for us on their factual accuracy. In other words, it does not matter to us whether blueprints were found buried 32 metres under the rubble in downtown Beirut. We are not concerned with facts if facts are considered to be self-evident objects always already present in the world. Furthermore, we hold that this common sense definition of facts, this theoretical primacy of facts, must be challenged. Facts have to be treated as processes. One of the questions we find ourselves asking is, how do we approach facts, not in their crude facticity, but through the complicated mediations by which facts acquire their immediacy? What we have are objects and stories that should not be examined through the conventional but reductive binary fiction and non-fiction. We proceed from the consideration that this distinction is a false one and does not do justice to the rich and complex stories that circulate widely and that capture our attention and belief. We must also say that it remains unclear to us what we mean by this proposition, but we are working on clarifying it. We do not consider the Lebanese Civil War to be a settled chronicle of events, dates, personalities, masochists, invasions, but rather we also want to consider it as an abstraction constituted by various discourses and, more importantly, by various modes of assimilating the data of the world. We proceed then from the hypothesis that the Lebanese Civil War is not a self-evident episode, an inert fact of nature. This war is not constituted by a unified or coherent object situated in the world. On the contrary, for us, the Lebanese Civil War is constituted by and through various actions, situations, people and accounts, some of which are manifest in the documents we presented. Not attempting to situate the war in this or that event, person, space and time, we ask and proffer answers to the following questions. How does one write a history of the civil wars in Lebanon? How are the objects, thoughts and emotions of the wars apprehended? This difficulty of thinking about and representing the various experiences that are constituted by and that constitute the Lebanese Civil War derives not simply from the plurality of experience, as determined by manifold class, sexual, gender, religious, ideological and political locations. More fundamentally, it remains difficult to describe specifically what we mean when we speak of the experience of the Civil War. How do we represent traumatic events of collective historical dimensions when the very notion of experience is itself in question? We have never referred to the Atlas Group as a fictional foundation. In most instances, we refer to the Atlas Group simply as a foundation. It is a foundation in the sense that with this project we are founding, building, setting on foot an operation and giving form to a project that is concentrated in the contemporary history of Lebanon. But if you are going to refer to the Atlas Group as a fictional foundation, then it is important to be precise about the definitions of the words fictional and foundation in order to avoid the definition of the Atlas Group as a product of the imagination with no material presence. We would refer to the Atlas Group as a fictional foundation if the word fictional connoted forming and fashioning and not arbitrary invention. We do not mind other definitions of fictional as feigning, counterfeit, dissimulation and pretense. Our aim with this project has never been to fool viewers and listeners by presenting stories and documents about anything and anyone in order to see what we can get away with. Our interest is in how certain stories and situations capture the attention and belief of viewers and listeners. But we are not investigating this phenomenon in the abstract, but specifically in relation to the history of Lebanon. We have always maintained that part of our interest with this project is to examine what has, is, and can be said, believed and known about Lebanon, its residents, history, culture, economy and politics. This project operates between what is sayable, believable and known as true or false. And we do not mean to imply that these terms have a negative relation to each other, that belief is the negative of knowledge, for example, nor that belief is a flawed cognitive relation to the world and knowledge is a correct one. If we proceed from the understanding that belief is a fundamental attitude that a person has when he or she holds that a proposition is true and that knowledge is certified true belief by virtue of evidence, then clearly we need to say about how any proposition becomes true or false and what constitutes evidence. In this regard, and as has been argued, it is clear that what we hold to be true is not necessarily consistent with what is true at the level of the senses, reason, consciousness, and discourse, but also with what holds to be true at the level of the unconscious. Hence, we would urge you to approach these documents we present as we do, as hysterical symptoms based not on any one person's actual memories, but on the cultural fantasies erected from the material of collective memories. Extract from Aji J, Culture Loss and Learned by Heart. Text, Emmanuel Aduma and Aji J, Spectre Books, 2021. The archive lends the past a palpability that makes probing it all the more difficult. How can we question what is reaffirmed through the dates on the documents, the type of paper, the ink, their order, the signs of aging, the crumbling paper in the researcher's hand, the smell of old glue, the carts of boxes and files, the way they are indexed? Because it can be touched, it feels true. But this is part of the archive's ontology. If there is no past, and if the past was the invention of the imperial archive, and if the keepers at its gates are guarding something else, it is a graveyard of political life that insists that time is a linear temporality, again, an imperial tautology. Whether artistic or scholarly, any response to the colonial archives, such as the one in Senegal, begins with the necessity to dismantle, or unlearn, in Azoulay's words, the tautology at the heart of the imperialism, whose chief manifestation for Africans was colonialism. This tautology, simply put, is the assumption that for the colonialized, those in need of colonialism, time only began when the empire turned its attention to them. Of course, this was not true. But in order to justify the necessity to subjugate, the French in Senegal and the British in Nigeria had to propose new identities that were consistent with their idea of civilization. And since identity is always in relation to time, since people ascribe meanings to themselves in relation to cosmology, history, myth, and other forms of origin stories. The most important work of colonialism was to specify when modernity began for the colonialized, which was always synchronous with the arrival of Europeans in African hinterlands. As a result, when one approaches the National Iconographic Archive of Senegal with decolonialization in mind, one insists that the past is not conterminous with the archive, that the past is not illuminated if we can manage to rescue abandoned reels and documents from degradation. What is essential is to propose a different timeline, to imagine a past in which the identities of the men and women pictured or documented in the colonial archive are not determined by their presence in it. Conversation between Emmanuel Aduma and Aji J. Emmanuel Idiom. Again, from Azoulay, we learn that it is impossible to enter the archive innocently, that the archive, being one of the major players invested in the naturalisation of imperial categories, cannot, in effect, produce anything but propaganda files. If we were to accept complicity as a precondition for entering archival institutions, how has that defined your relationship with the National Iconographic Archives?
AGJ.
At the outset of Azulay's cognitation on the archive, she discusses the importance of talking about the nation-state and its assertion of neutrality through the fixture of these institutions. In formulating a definition of the archive and potential history, she outlines the problems of understanding history as belonging to the past and describes the past as an invention of the nation-state, which obscures its own imperial violence and conveys a clean, sanitized image of itself in the present days. Here, national archives have created their own narrative as gatekeepers of the past, fully embodying the idea of history as detached from both the present and the future. Approaching the archive by rejecting such notions of archival content and understanding that what is presented to us is actually propaganda material can allow us to unveil the embedded violence present within the archival institution and its seamlessly neutral content. In the National Iconographic Archives of Senegal, I find the line between the topics covered in the archive and the individuals and institutions maintaining it to be slightly more ambiguous than in the case of Israel and Palestine. Here, the imperial relationship between those who created the archives, the subjugators, and the subjects of the archives is such that the category of the subjugated becomes more ambiguous through or after Senegal's independence in 1960. For me, when considering that the formerly colonialized subjects of the archive became the heads of this imperial institution that the independent state of Senegal has chosen to make its national archives, it is pivotal to understand how a post-independent country uses the same imperial technology once used to exercise hegemony over its people in representing its culture heritage today. In doing so, I want to understand how the violence and the potential resistance present within the archival material and its institution played a role in the conception of an independent state. Certainly, entering the archive and being granted access to it could be criticised as producing a tautological relationship. The way I deal with this through my artistic practice is by trying to find ways in which my position and identification as a spectator and subject of the archive creates a temporal relationship to issues that affect millennials like me and people from younger generations. With my work, which begins with a complicity with the archival institution, try to break the cycle of violence that certain images portray. For instance, by avoiding the use of images from colonial postcards and other similar images. Instead, I look at official images from the post-independent era of the 1960s, which focus on the construction of infrastructure and the theoretical presence of politicians of the time. They are still violent images, but their violence requires further decoding. Emmanuel Idema. I was struck by the photographs of the International Iconographic Archives that you shared with me, the dusty files and abandoned reels. To me, they highlighted the necessity of thinking about a non-progressive approach to a history, a way to potentialise history. I'm curious whether your treatment of the images from the archive or your ideas for how to deal with these images in the future correspond with an interest in potentialising history.
AGJ.
Well, the archival images I used for this project belong to an already taxonomised and preserved part of the iconographic archives, hence my interest in understanding the narratives this national institution created for itself. The form I use to deal with these taxonomised materials is determined very much in relation to what I want to say specifically in an installation or video. In the case of the series of installations, for instance, the repetitiveness in the treatment of the image in a dot bitmap formula allows me to manually silkscreen the image, but it doesn't allow full access to the images I chose. I'm more interested in displaying parts that are relevant to my narrative and finding a way that fully exposes the unreliability of the historical timeline. In the case of the second installation, Let Me, for instance, my concern with the treatment of the images has different layers.
Beginning from the colours, the installation starts with a warm red, referencing the poem C'est 5 heures by former President Léopold Sédar Senghor, in which he uses the red colour to create a link between the terrain of the island of Gori and the blood of the people who walked this soil during the slave trade. The installation ends with a vibrant red symbolising the Chinese Aid Company and its gift of the Museum of Black Art to the Senegalese state. I treat the images in a different way, for instance, in the video for Memory. There, the images don't use the bitmap effect, but rather are left in their original form, simply printed on small squares. The same is true of the memory game. Here, my activation of the archives comes from simply using my hands to turn over the cards and try to find the corresponding image. The idea behind this approach is to discuss the ways in which one could learn about linear history in a playful manner that exempts the player from the questioning what it is that presented to them as something that needs to be learned. This is a preoccupation that very much reflects my engagement in understanding the history and contemporaneity of the colonialism and the creation of the nation-state of Senegal, which in a way places me in an almost infertile position. The images chosen are the ones that recur most often in the archive. The construction of infrastructure, colonial generals, the two presidents of the post-independence era, and political events. To be honest, defining my work in the words of Azoulay as a form of potentializing history would, in a certain sense, sound arrogant to me. What I'm sure of is that my intentions and hopefully the outcomes function as a means of activating a rejection of the violence contained in many of the notions that we previously discussed, such as that of the timeline. Emmanuel Idemer. You conceive of this project not just an installation, but an artistic intervention, a collective action that allows you to raise critical questions around archives and national narratives. Why have you deemed it necessary to move beyond an aesthetic response and to engage in this work as a citizen of Senegalese diaspora?
Ajij.
In the initial text I wrote about culture loss and learned by heart, I mentioned that my other intention for this project would be to collaborate with the Institution of National Archives of Senegal and the Department of Archival Studies at the University of Chiek Anta Diop to develop solutions to restore some parts of the archives that are in a visible state of deterioration. However, one of the major questions one must ask when thinking about embarking on such a project is, why are the archives in the state they are today? These materials were meant to be created, taxonomised and preserved for the time the archives were founded in 1913. So what can we learn from their current state? Look at the history of national institutions in former colonial contexts like Senegal. One shouldn't be surprised by society's continued indifference towards them. The very material constituting the archive was created to study the country's landscape and inhabitants and therefore to exercise continued homogeny over them throughout time. When I think of my Senegalese cultural heritage, I think of my family and the Islamic Mauride culture I grew up in. I think of a living archive that never came to me through documents. However, the physical places I and many others inhabit, especially in the major cities of Senegal, were not built to serve other local cultures. Therefore, I believe that being able to tap into the archival material can inform us not only on our colonial past, but also our present. To me, this project began as a space for introspection, a sort of homeschool I created for myself and others, and it continued to be that. The greatest collective action that could occur, in my humble opinion, would be to see other artists and creatives reflecting on and activating the archive through their communal and individual perspectives. This would mean reframing the archive through the self and the community, and displacing it from its position of neutrality and hence historical factuality. I don't believe that art will save the world, but to reduce an artistic practice to a mere aesthetic reaction would be like saying that the writings of a poet or a philosopher are just words in response to something. My main preoccupation at the moment is with being able to position myself in relation to some of the many questions that I raise in Culture Loss and Learned by Heart. In doing so, I want to use the privilege that a European passport gives to me by organising ways to tangibly and collectively intervene in some of the deteriorated parts of the National Iconographic Archives. As of right now, I'm still learning and understanding how all of this could work, and it's most certainly the case that my art and that of others inspires me to create a conceptual framework for how to intervene in the actual archival material. It's also important to underline that others in Senegal are already actively working on restoring deteriorating archival materials in different archives. So for me, observing what is already taking place is an important source of learning